Good morning. I would like to call the meeting of the House Education Committee of the 34th Legislature to order. It is 8:05 a.m. Wednesday, March 20th, 2026, in the Betty Davis Room 106 in the Capitol. Members present today are Rep. Eichheit, Rep. Schwanke, Rep. Dibert, Rep. Elam has an excused absence today, co-chair Rep. Himshute, and myself, Rep. Story, co-chair. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum for conducting business. Please take time to silence your cell phones for the meeting. The documents for today's meetings have been distributed to members and are available on the table outside the door and on basis. I want to thank Cale Brown, the House Education Secretary, for records for his good work, and also Zach Lawhorn from the Juneau LIO for staffing our committee meeting today. And, of course, our co-chair committee aides Tammy Smith and Ella Lubin. For our agenda today, the House Education Committee will be hearing two bills. First, House Bill 261, an act relating to education funding. This bill ensures a timelier education funding process by switching the funding process to use an average of the prior three-year student count, otherwise known as the average daily membership, or the previous year student count, or otherwise known as the average daily membership, whichever is greater, to ensure greater budget stability for communities and to be able to offer teacher contracts earlier in the spring to increase retention and recruitment. After that, we will hear from Representative Freer on House Bill 231, an education bill she is sponsoring, also regarding teacher retention and recruitment. At this time, I am going to take a brief at ease and hand the gavel over to co-chair Representative Himshute.
Okay, we're back on record. I want to also welcome Representative Underwood. She joined the committee at 8:06 a.m. And we're going to take up House Bill 261. As discussed in our last hearing on House Bill 261, there is a committee substitute on this bill. So I'd like to invite Representative Story and her staff to present the committee substitute and the summary of changes for the CS to HB 261. An act relating to education funding. Representative Story, could you please put yourself on record and begin your presentation?
Good morning, Co-Chair Rem Himshute and my fellow Education Committee members. For the record, my name is Representative Andy Story, and I have the honor of representing the North Mendenhall Valley here in Juneau, Fritz-Cove area, out the road, Auk Bay, Haines, Skagway, Cluckwan, and Gustavus. Such a beautiful area. I wanted to remind people before Tammy Smith, my staff aide, goes over the sectional analysis, the goal in the CS. We discussed this 2 weeks ago, perhaps, about the committee bringing back a committee substitute to this education funding process bill. Remember, we are trying to fix our backward budgeting problem for the education our education communities and our communities in general. The goal in the CES was to maintain the three-year averaging or the previous year average daily membership, and to maintain the 100 and 425 student count for facilities. I'm having a three-year averaging for that too. So that was the goal that's maintained, of course, in the CS. Also, we were in the CS, we were looking to reduce the fiscal note. Being aware of our financial situation. And so one way we did that in the CS that was talked about was with how we reduced the cost of the intensive student count. When you take a three-year average of the intensive student count, you might be averaging in one district having an intensive student count, having a student who is not in that student count. And so that inflated the numbers. And so what we did in this bill when we go through the CS is we did not allow for an average of a three-year student count, but we allowed for taking the prior student count, because that would have been your, for an example, if this would go into effect July 1st of 2026, it would have been your student count from 2025, your fall student count, and it would have had the advantage of being reconciled, going through the whole process with DEED, where they verify if there's a duplication of students in one district and another. I think, as you all remember, DEED goes through and reconciles the student count from the 20-day student count period in October. And so that has the advantage of being done by July 1st, so districts could pick that number for the intensive student count. Or they can pick the current year count. Because, as you know, when students arrive in the fall, if they are an intensive student, they are at quite, they have complex needs, and you need to hire a staff person right away. And then also, the student count stays the same, that it does allow the average of the intensive student count stays the same, in that you can have a true up in February. So that was the intensive. So we just made one change. The CS does in that. We also took out the alternative school language. And this was right now there is a problem with how alternative schools are funded. If they are in a school district of 750 students or more, they are put into the larger high school. I'm just sort of reminding everybody about the problem with this. And they are a smaller school community. And I've given the example of Juneau Douglas Yaja Akale High School. The Yakutsk students, our alternative school, are put into that one. And the students at JDHS, Yada Akale, are worth 0.84 of a student count because they are above 750. And a smaller school, such as around 85 students, would be worth a 1-point-something factor. I'm sorry, I don't know that for sure. But so anyway, I took that out. I have heard feedback from districts with alternative schools that they would have preferred to keep it in, but I was looking at the number of that. But I do want to say, hopefully we adopt the CS, of course there'll be amendment deadline, and maybe someone would choose to bring that back after talking to their districts that we feel that is worth funding, or that may come back in a bill at a different year. But anyway, that would be an option of the committee as we work on this bill. And then what other change was made in this bill was to grandfather in the current districts who are in hold harmless status. So as we switch to, if we decide to switch to the three-year averaging, there are some districts in hold harmless status. And in talking with them, it seems appropriate to leave them within that status, and then they would phase into the three-year average. The other thing we counted for in the CS is if there's a new school formed in the middle of, as we go in the future, that is in here. And then the other thing that is added is if you see an enrollment in the fall of 5% or more, then you can take your current year accounting. And why that was important is in talking, especially to smaller districts, if they get a 5% bump in a smaller district, it's significant revenue to them, and it helps them very much plan a curriculum, because in smaller schools, I mean, that is significant. And so anyway, that is also in this bill. And I've probably gone on a little too long about the changes, because my co-worker here, Tammy Smith, is going to go through the sectional analysis, but I tried to make it a little bit more friendly. The summary of changes, excuse me, for the sectional analysis. So thank you for those liberties. And after she has done that, I'm happy to take any questions about that.
So, Co-Chair Story, are you wanting to go through the sectional analysis before we adopt the CS? The summary of changes.
It's up to you, Co-Chair.
Okay, it might be helpful for the committee to know what's changed before we adopt it. So, Ms. Smith.
Good morning, Tammy Smith, for the record, and I am staff to Representative Story. And just so that the committee knows, there is an updated sectional analysis, and we are dealing with version. We were dealing with version N. It is now version I. So there is a new sectional analysis for version I, and I am going to do the summary of changes for version I at this point. So just to make clear, the summary of changes just deals with what was changed from the original version N to I. So section 5 and 6, it's just conforming language, just with the relettering and renumbering of the section as necessary. Section 7 deletes the date of October 15th and restores the average daily membership student count period for the intensive needs students to the last day of the count period. That is currently what we have in statute and what will remain in statute. And then we will delete the use of the three-year averaging ADM or whichever is greater for the intensive needs count. It still allows for three options for the ADM intensive needs count periods, which will be the use of the current enrollment fiscal year student enrollment count or the use of the previous enrollment fiscal year student enrollment count or the use of the second count by February 15th of the current year should the district choose to conduct an additional student enrollment count. In Section 8, it amends the ADM calculation wording, whichever is greater to greater of. It changes the word previous to prior year in the first part of the definition of the calculation to the district's prior three-year average ADM reported in the previous fiscal year under AS 14600 and the district's ADM reported in the previous fiscal year under 14-17-600. And then it adds the new language, as Representative was talking about, where new language, which will allow for districts to use the current ADM of the fiscal year if the district exceeds the greater of the ADM described in either one or two of this subsection by 5% or more under AS 14-17-600. Section 9 amends to conform with the changes described above in Section 8, AS 14-17-600, 1 under AS 14-17-905, and it does that by all they're doing in Section 9 is changing the word from previous to prior, and then it amends the language to conform with the changes described above in Section A, which was the special ed intensive needs count where it deletes the reference to October 15th and it restores the student count period language. So those were both just conforming changes there. In Section 13, it amends the language again to conform with the changes described above in Section 17. Section 7, under AS 1417-420A2B, and it deletes references to the intensive funding, intensive needs funding count. And again, that's just conforming language. In Section 14, deletes the alternative school with the ADM of less than 175 to be counted as one school. So it deletes that language, and it restores it to the current statute language under AS 1417-905A3. Section 15 adds language to align community or charter school ADM with the language described above in Section 8 under 1417-600. And in Section 16 adds language to define prior described above in Section 8 under AS 17600A. Prior three-year average ADM means the number resulting from combining the ADM counts from the three student count periods immediately preceding a student count period under AS 14600A for a fiscal year and dividing that sum by three. In Section 20, it adds a new section to the transition language of hold harmless, which allows districts currently in hold harmless or have met the requirements for eligibility on or before July 1st of 2026 to calculate the school district school size adjustment until the school district is no longer eligible under AS 1410B1E through G. And Section 21, it's transition language to conform with the changes described above in Section 7 and 8 under AS 17600A, which deals with the student count period. And I can take, and that is the summary of changes.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Smith. Are there questions from the committee on the summary of changes? Seeing none, I'm looking for a motion. Representative Eichheit.
Thank you, Co-Chair Hemschut. I move the adoption of the committee substitute to House Bill 261, Work Order 34-LS1293, /I as in India.
Are there any objections? Seeing no objections, the committee substitute is adopted. Adopts the CS for House Bill 261 version I. I would like to set an amendment deadline for the CS, House Bill 261 version 1, for Wednesday, May 25th, March.
It's Friday.
Wow. Wednesday, March 25th at noon. Please have the amendments to my office or Rep Story's office by noon on March 25th. We're going to take a brief at ease to go back to a true professional Representative Story at ease.
I will call the House Education Committee back to order. We are now going to turn our attention to House Bill 261, having to do with teacher
231.
231, thank you. 231, having to do with teacher retention and recruitment. And this is a bill by Representative Freer, and I would like to invite her to the table and her staff, Lucretia Wilson. Please introduce yourself for the record and begin your opening statements. I want to note that we also have online program director Kelly Manning from the Department of Education and Early Development to answer questions, as well as Mr. Dan Wayne from Legislative Legal. So please, welcome, introduce yourself, and begin your presentation.
Thank you, Co-Chair Story, Co-Chair Hemshoot, and all of you on the Education Committee for having us back before you to hear for the second time, House Bill 231. During the last hearing, we had about 15 minutes to very quickly go over introduction and through the presentation. Your staff, Ms. Lubin, put the summary of changes on record. We do have the sectional analysis if the Education Committee would like to hear that. Otherwise, I believe we have invited testimony on the line. And we have folks in the room with there are two presentations, I believe, and then other folks, and then if it pleases the committee, however you would like to proceed.
Thank you, Rep. Freer. I've noted that I'm looking for my sectional analysis. It's quite long. If I would perhaps note
3 pages.
What's 3 pages long? Yes, I was thinking we would go forward with invited testimony and then we can see at the end of all our presentations and discussions this morning if we would like to go through the sectional analysis. But I think it helps us understand the bill. And so please, would you like to turn to invited testimony right away, or did you have a presentation you wanted to give?
Co-Chair Story, I don't have any further presentation, so invited testimony would be welcome. However, they have presentations.
Wonderful. Thank you for that. And I see from my notes that we have Jennifer Schmitz, director from the Alaska Education Retention and Recruitment Center, the director there in the room. So I would like to invite her to the table to have her introduce herself and begin testimony.
I think I forgot to put myself on record as well.
Please, go ahead.
For the record, Robin Nayok Freer, representative for House District 40. I was like, wait, did I? Thanks. Okay.
Welcome, Director Schmitz. Please introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Story, Co-Chair Hemshoot, and members of the House Education Committee. Thank you for the opportunity to provide invited testimony today. For the record, my name is Jennifer Schmitz. I am the Director of the Alaska Educator Retention and Recruitment Center. We are a division of the Alaska Council of School Administrators. ACSA supports all education leaders in Alaska, as well as teachers throughout our staff development network. And now through ARC, we also help support districts with their retention and recruitment needs. Today, I'm going to share some data about recruitment and retention challenges and about how House Bill 231 directly addresses those challenges. So the reality, I know that this isn't new information to any of you that are in this room. It is our current reality. We started the year with over 345 unfilled teaching positions, teaching vacancies. We currently have 573 teachers working on visas, and we also started the year with 285 emergency certificates. And that is, I think I could say, a record high right now for all of these numbers. Emergency certificates, I just want to be clear, are used when a district maybe can't find a qualified teacher to be in that position. It might be a paraprofessional that gets an emergency cert to teach a class. It might be somebody working towards a degree. It's also something that's given to our international teachers because they can't go straight to a certificate, and so they will serve on an emergency certificate while they're taking the time to take the praxis test and get their certificate. So they're not necessarily the preference They're kind of a last resort, but it's one of the things that we're using to fill our classrooms. And those are district-sponsored certificates, so the district has to sign saying that they're monitoring this person, they trust that this person's doing the right thing, and put them in charge of a classroom.
Excuse me, Ms. Schmitz. We have a question from Rep. Hemshoot.
Do you want questions at the end or as you're going along?
It's entirely up to you.
Okay. Through the co-chair, my question is, this is a great slide. The context of the slide is awesome, but additional context, how many teachers are there in state overall? So is it like 8,000?
Oh, I should know that. I don't know that. Can I ask behind me real quick?
Yeah, sure. Call a friend.
Have a number for me? Anybody?
Well, can I get back to you on that?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah, thanks.
Sorry about that. I should have that in front of me. I would add that in a perfect world, this chart, all three of those boxes would have a zero in them. We would have zero unfilled positions. We would have zero teachers that were on visas, and we would have zero emergency certificates on the first day. But, I mean, to be clear, our international teachers are doing a good job, but it's expensive. Immigration is complicated. It makes districts do a lot more paperwork. And so what we're looking for is teachers from Alaska and teachers from the U.S. to fill these positions. But this is our reality today.
Excuse me, Ms. Schmitz. We
yes.
have a question from Rep. Schwanke.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Thank you, Ms. Schmitz. I just had kind of a question on that first number again. I know we've seen the graph a few times of the unfilled first day teaching vacancies, and I feel like under one of the deed presentations we got, it was maybe 314 this year. But my question about that number, and you may not know, do we know how many of those teaching positions have been vacant for more than a year?
Through the chair, to Rep. Schwanke, I don't know if we have tracked if it's the same position year after year after year or if it's just the number that's the same. So I don't really know the answer to that.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you for that question, Rep. Schwanke. And if that would be helpful to have that information as well as the the number of teachers in the state.
Okay.
Thank you. And we have a question from Rep. Eichheid.
Thank you, Co-Chair Story. Very quickly, thank you, Director Schmitz. This is very interesting. The first number, 345 plus. Explain the plus, because that creates a sense of uncertainty on that number.
Thank you, through the chair, to Rep. Eichheid. We have a plus there because we really believe that there's probably more than that in the state. We've seen numbers, as somebody just said, at 317. We've seen numbers at 345. Last year we saw numbers at 600, but I did hear Deed explain that they did a different way of getting numbers this year. That it's just teachers that have classrooms in front of them and not the extra positions like reading coaches or behavior coaches. That it's just classroom teachers.
Thank you for that. Please proceed.
Okay. I believe that this is data that you have all seen before as well. What has changed is the acceleration of our retention. There was a drop during COVID because people stayed put, but since 2020, more educators are leaving schools, both teachers and principals, and it's really not a trend that's going in the right direction. I was born and raised in Anchorage, and went to school, and I can remember at Willow Crest Elementary School in first grade and second grade talking about who we wanted for fifth grade and sixth grade, and those teachers were still there in fifth grade and sixth grade, and they were still there when my little brother went to school and got to have the same teachers I had. And that's not the reality anymore, and we want to get that back to being our reality. That level of churn just makes it really difficult for stable schools and isn't good for our students. This is also another slide that I'm sure the data that this committee has seen before. It's the same information, but it breaks it down by rural and urban remote area, or urban and rural remote areas. I think at one time teacher turnover was more prevalent in rural areas, but you can see from this slide that it is a challenge in our rural and urban areas now. The difference here is with principals. Rural Alaska is seeing principal turnover as high as 55%, more than half of the rural principals leaving, and that creates a leadership gap, and it really affects our students and our communities. Losing leaders year after year is an issue. And this came up, you may be familiar, I know you're familiar with the TRR playbook. In 2021, part of that process, they did a survey of over 3,000 teachers and asking teachers why they stay or why they leave. And they're in the top 10 reasons. I would say that six of the top 10 reasons had to do with leadership, which is very interesting. Six of the top 10. That's very telling. Things like, wrote them down, positive workplace conditions, manageable workload, being treated as a professional, quality support from principals, quality support from district administration, things like that are really related to the leadership in a school and in a district. So high principal turnover definitely affects teacher retention as well. I like this slide because it really paints that picture fairly well to understand. I think sometimes people ask, well, it's not as disruptive for a principal to leave as it is for a teacher, but that's not really the case. The research shows from the Wallace Foundation that replacing a principal can cost upwards of $75,000 to $100,000. And can take 1 to 3 years for a school to really recover. And when a principal leaves, you can see to the next box, it really creates system disruption. The school climate suffers. PD, that was professional development that was going well, can stop if somebody else comes in and is doing something different. And educators lose support from that person that was their leader that was helping them. And so then that in turn leads to teacher turnover spiking. Teachers are feeling not supported, not feeling like it's that it's a strong place to be because the leaders keep coming and going. And then that, of course, in turn affects students. Instructional quality drops, leads to decreased learning and achievement. And that's the whole reason that we're here today, is we want the very best education for all the students in Alaska. And so this is just an example to show that principal turnover is as disruptive or more as teacher turnover. And that was the cost of replacing a principal. There's also definitely a cost of replacing teachers. An ICER study, we haven't seen it new data since 2017, but an ICER study in 2017 said that it cost about $20,000 to replace a teacher. So running that number through with inflation today, approximately $27,000. And these are the things that we don't necessarily think about, the hidden costs of replacing a teacher, the administration piece of it, the recruitment piece of it, what it takes for hiring, and then the orientation and training piece to get that teacher up to speed with everything that's going on in the school, in the community, with professional development is the biggest part of that piece. So it's not just tough on schools, tough on communities, and really hard on our children, but it's also hard on school budgets.
Thank you, Director Schmitz. We have questions. I have Rep. Dibert, Rep. Schwanke, and Rep. Hemshoot, and I did want to put on record, and this is from Dominic Johnson in the room, that there are 6,675 teachers in the state of Alaska. So, Rep. Dibert.
Yes, good morning through the co-chair to Ms. Schmitz. Thank you for being here. Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm looking at the slide that's a cyclical slide. This is a really great slide. And I was just thinking about that statement on the top box that says can take 1 to 3 years to recover. And I'm just thinking, as a classroom teacher, how long it took me to be solid at my job, I think. Mm-hmm. Maybe 7 or 8 years before I was like, okay, I got this. I've got the management. I've got the grading. I've got the curriculum down. I've got writing newsletters and talking to parents. And I think that took about 7 or 8 years just as a classroom teacher. Is there any study out there that does that for principals? Like, how many years does it take for a principal to be solid at their job or, you know, stable maybe. Mm-hmm. Thank you, through the co-chair.
Thank you.
Thank you. Through the chair to Representative Dybert. There is some data, and I'd be happy to get it to you, mostly from the Wallace Foundation. And it's actually different for elementary, middle, and high school as far as how long it takes for a principal to make changes at those levels and to get confident in their positions. But, and I think 1 to 3 personally is even a little bit on the low end for administration. I know when I left the classroom, that was one of the things that was the hardest for me to wrap my brain around. As a teacher, I was trying to figure out how where I wanted to get my students from the beginning of the year to the end of the year. And as a principal, it was more like 5 years out, where am I going to be? I have to spend a year building relationships. I have to spend a year getting to know the community before I'm doing too much. And so if that constant churn is happening, then it's really being felt by teachers and students. And we're not getting our skills honed in the way they need to be, for sure. Thank you.
Thank you. We have Rep. Schwanke.
Thank you, through the chair. I think I've asked this question before on the record, but I really appreciate Representative Dybert's comment there, because that was probably and still is probably my biggest concern as a school board member initially, and even now. It takes a number of years for any professional to really be truly solid at their job. It's just a fact. And it always bothered me that teaching contracts are very short-term contracts, and they're literally annual when they start. So every educator comes in, and they're scared to death that they're not going to get a contract the next year. And so my question on some of this turnover, I think it would be really incredibly helpful for us to have data on not just the teacher turnover, but principal turnover. How much of the turnover is individuals not being extended a contract versus leaving voluntarily? And I cannot encourage enough a change in thinking when it comes to contracts in the education world. We have to start doing longer term contracts for people in the professional world of education, because this 1 to 3 year thing is just, it's very difficult for somebody to really truly feel comfortable finding and seeking mentorship. I've seen educators that, especially new educators that stepped into the world of special education because they knew that there was an opening there that needed to be filled, and they asked a lot of questions, and then they were not retained at the end of that because they asked too many questions. And I just don't understand that process. So any knowledge that you might have, or even just information for the future on that difference between not being offered a contract and leaving voluntarily would be really helpful, I think, for us.
Thank you. Through the chair to Rep. Schwanke, I think that's a great thing for us to survey, because I think that is good data, and I'm not sure that it's out there now. And I would agree with you on the contracts, and we talk about this. I belong to some groups that people doing my job in other states that feel the exact same way about that and are working to see longer contracts with educators. Appreciate that. Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you. Next, I have Rep. Hemshut.
Thank you, through the chair. I wanted to stay on that slide with the cycle, and I wanted to share an anecdote. But I also want to point out, in those first 3 years, the quality of a teacher is very much determined by the leadership of the school and how much that principal is investing in that teacher. Mm-hmm. And so those annual contracts are an opportunity for correction and change. And so I don't have a strong opinion on a 1 year versus a 2 year versus a 3 year, but tenure is on the first day of your fourth year, so that is definitely a driver. But my comment really was just a quick anecdote. I couldn't help but bring this up. I started with the principal in my school in 2004, and then she cycled out, and we had a different principal for a short time, and then I had my my most long-term principal started in 2010, and he was an incredible leader, had some experience, came from within the district, and my career was spent mostly in Sitka, which is a very stable environment. A lot of our educators come from Sitka, grew up there, and became teachers there. So we're really lucky to have a fairly stable environment. But he and I were within a year of each other as far as retirement. And I kept saying, you can't go before me because I don't have it in me to train a new principal. And my point, as arrogant as that sounds, my point was that we had the longevity that made us a really great working team in my school, and the disruption of a new principal is felt throughout the system. So we were lucky not to have a lot of, and then he did leave before me, and we got an excellent replacement also who had made her career in Seco School District. So, I just wanted to share that anecdote that you feel it at the teaching level, and you feel it then at the classroom student level, and then at the family level. Mm-hmm. So it is a big deal. Mm-hmm. That's all I wanted to say.
Thank you.
We have Rep. Ishai.
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair Story. I'm just burning to make this comment, having been a teacher for 25 years in the same school. And we've seen some numbers here, which I am a number person. I'm a scientist, so numbers appeal to me. But what I think it's really important for the committee to know and the public to know that when you have a stable school staff, teachers, support staff, and principals, what does that really mean? It means for me, as Representative Himshute said, you know, I had a good principal to start out, and that allowed me to become a teacher, which takes time. The other thing is, during that 25 years, I had whole families. And what does that mean? That means the family knows me as a teacher. I know the family. Siblings talk. And I was in it long enough that I had the children of former students. Mm-hmm. There's something you can't quantify about that. And then the other thing I'll say is when you have a school with veteran staff, because I was at the same building long enough to have a number of principals, not all principals are created equal. And when you have stable staff, during those times when you have a weak principal, well, it helps us help the principal, train the principal, but it also helps us together as a staff continue teaching in the disruption of a weak principal. Mm-hmm. And so the context is if you have constant turnover in teaching or administrative staff, it impacts students. It impacts their learning. And we want to make sure people that are good at teaching and love teaching stay in that profession. It takes a while, as Representative Dybert said, to hone your craft. Mm-hmm. If people constantly are coming in and leaving, we never quite get there. And that's the goal. So I just want to make that statement. Thank you.
Thank you for that comment. Please proceed with your presentation.
Thank you. Excuse me. So that was some of the data to set the stage for House Bill 231. This work is not new. It's not reactive. The work began in 2020 with the governor's working group focused on looking at retention and recruitment. The playbook was published. The retention and recruitment playbook was published in 2023. In 2024, there was an RFP for a backbone organization. We accepted that three-year contract, and that's how ARC first came to be. The contract was ended suddenly last spring, but we had strong momentum going and with school districts, and we're doing a lot of support and made the decision to continue the work. And you're going to see then that some in the playbook, and you've seen this before, some of the things that are in there have to be addressed through policy. And that's what Rep. Freer realized and was willing to sponsor this bill to get some of that policy out there today that's related to implementing the playbook. The bill implements those recommendations. It's vetted. It's data-driven strategy that was really developed by the state under the leadership of our governor. This slide is just quick to show the TRR playbook recommendations. And when the playbook was published, there were six categories. This is a little confusing, but enhancing recruitment efforts, creating paraprofessional pathways, streaming certification, restructuring retirement, strengthening working conditions, and developing leadership. So those are the six plan recommendation areas. The ones in gold are things under each of those that are addressed in House Bill 231. This is another fun slide. If you picture a pipeline, it's just a straight pipeline. Thank you very much. We want to expand that pipeline, and this bill helps do that. We want to widen that pool of candidates. We want that pipe to go bigger, and we want lots and lots of candidates in the pool. That's the recruitment piece of it. However, if we only focus on recruitment, it's like pouring water into a shattered glass. It's just going to go straight through. We have to spend time focused on retention strategies as well. And so those gold blocks in the middle, that's that leak prevention to stop the teachers from coming and going straight through our state and leaving. And those yellow blocks are the pieces of House Bill 231 that's going to stop that flow from going through that pipeline. So for the sake of this bill, I divided the parts of the bill into three pillars: financial health and direct incentives, environment and working conditions, and then leadership support and pipeline expansion. And those are the areas in the bill, and I'm going to talk about those just a little bit more. First pillar is financial health and direct incentives. So the first one, retention bonuses. Retention bonuses help keep educators in hard-to-staff districts. Bonuses were something that our governor really wanted to see happen, and financial incentives are also mentioned in the playbook. It's interesting. I know there's a lot of back-and-forth talk about bonuses and if it's a good thing or a bad thing. There was a superintendent from Alaska recently who goes to Pennsylvania every year to a big job fair because there's some schools in Pennsylvania that put out a lot of teachers. And that's one that he's gone to year after year. And he signed up to go this year, and they called and said, "You're welcome to come, but we have put bonuses into our system in the state to keep teachers here, and they're not leaving anymore. And so we don't want you to come here and think that you've wasted your time because you're not going to get as many people to leave because they were having a lot of success with their bonuses." So, and there's quite a few different states that are following suit, and we believe that that would be helpful to keep teachers here. And something that had a lot of discussion and Rep. Freer felt strongly about, and we do as well, is adding paraprofessionals to that so that it's not just teachers. I don't think there's anybody that would argue that paraprofessionals are a really strong part of our education system, are as important to our student success as teachers. They really are important pieces. The middle one, retirement flexibility. This also kind of focuses a little bit on paraprofessionals. We have a lot of grow your own programs going in across the state. The Department of Ed is sponsoring some apprenticeships and Department of Labor. And these encourage our paraprofessionals and other people that are not teachers to become teachers. And one of the barriers for some of them was that they've been vested and spent a lot of time in the PERS retirement system, and switching to become a teacher, they have to leave that system and go to TERS. And some of them, that was a barrier, and they didn't want to move forward because they wanted to keep that. So this bill allows for that flexibility to stay in PERS and still go on to be a teacher. And then that last box, financial planning and support. I mean, it seems simple, but our teachers today don't have a defined benefit program that's saving for them for retirement. So they really need to be supported in decisions that they're making long-term with their money so that they can still look for retirement and long-term planning. And so this requires districts to provide that, or the state to provide that planning for teachers.
Excuse me, Director Schmitz, we have a question from Rep. Hemshute.
Thank you, through the chair. Ms. Schmitz, how do you define hard-to-staff schools? So I see the bonuses, and I've seen that they're also on the urban and then fringe or rural and then remote. So what are you saying about hard-to-staff?
Well, it is – I wish I had that in front of me. You probably have that with the bill. It is spread out by location and by school size and by rural remote, and just the the long-term data, I believe, shows that it's harder to staff our really remote areas. And so the bonuses are bigger in those areas than it is in the urban areas.
Okay. It would be helpful to have, through the chair, it'd be helpful to have data to back that up.
Yep.
Thanks. Rabbi Scheid.
Thank you, Co-Chair Story. I noticed the financial planning support. Of course, I sponsored House Bill 90 that would require that for high school students here in Alaska. But when I was a teacher in Wisconsin, my state teachers union offered a series of financial planning seminars for teachers, and I took several, and it really helped me.
Excellent.
So, anyways, I appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you.
And I have a question. I wanted to know, do bonuses count towards the retirement in either TERS or PERS, or is the bonus added to the amount calculated in the final retirement amount?
That is not something, through the chair, that is not something that I know the answer to. I don't know if there's somebody online or in the room that would know the answer to that.
We can, look to that at a later time.
Okay. I will get that to you.
Okay. Thank you.
After the presentation, I think we can get the answer.
Thank you.
Okay.
Please
proceed. Thank you. The next pillar is environment and working conditions. And working conditions come up a lot in talking with teachers. And these are three pieces of this bill related to working conditions. One of them is educator housing. The bill has some two different kinds of grants for districts. One of them is a subsidy grant to help districts offset the cost of teacher housing. Some districts do offer housing, but it can still be really expensive, and so this would be a way for districts to apply for grants to help subsidize the cost for teacher housing. And then there's also housing upgrade grants. And the thought behind that is there are some communities that might have an old school that they're not using anymore, or parts of a school that that might be a school that was built for 1,000 students and there's only 300 students now. And there could be pieces of that school that could be turned into teacher housing. And this would encourage districts to use buildings and places that are already there to turn it into housing, which could help with recruitment and retention both for staff. And then infrastructure and connectivity. We've been talking about this for a long time. It's just to improve access to good, strong internet for teachers and for students. Students need to have technology to compete in the century and to compete in the workforce when they're done with college, when they're done with school. And it's just not equitable for everyone. Connectivity shouldn't be dependent on where you live. It should be available to everybody. And beyond being used for teaching, I would argue that it's also a retention piece. When you are a brand new teacher in an area that is very rural, remote, being connected to family outside and to friends outside and to other teachers for ideas, teachers pay teachers programs where they get activities for classrooms, social media, being able to watch Netflix. I mean, things like that are doesn't seem like it's related to education, but it's related to retention and keeping people comfortable in where they live. So we need to make sure that every district and every community has good internet. And then exit interviews and data. We love this one too because we want, and like many of you, like data, right? You like data. We want the data of why people are leaving. We have ideas. We've done surveys. But if we get the real data to tell why they're leaving or why they're staying, we can use that information to work on retention strategies with districts and help coach them. And the state has a survey that's going out right now that's going to do just that in partnership with ICER, which is excellent. We're very excited to get that information so that we can use it. And this is in the bill so that that's not just a one-time thing, that it continues so that we can continue to work on it and support districts.
We have a question from Rep. Ishaid. Of Rep. Hemshoot.
Yeah, that was my question. So.
Oh, yes. And then the last pillar, and we've talked about this a little bit with the leadership slide already, is leadership support and pipeline expansion and supporting our leaders and increasing the number of people that we have. The bill supports leaders the bill supports mentoring for leaders. This is not new. In 2014, through the Superintendents Association, ACSA started NIS, the New and Incoming Superintendent Support. This program provides our early career superintendents with collaboration opportunities, professional development, and coaching by certified coaches. When I became a principal in 2005, I had a mentor through the State Mentorship Project that I really believe helped me get off on the right foot. I worked with that person and that program for my first 2 years as a principal, and I still think about and use pieces of that mentoring that I got all that time ago. And that program lost funding, and there wasn't one for a while, and districts were left to do their own mentoring and figure it out on their own. And I know that there were some districts that just couldn't do that. 8 years ago, in partnership with DEED and under Commissioner Johnson, ACSA started it back up again with our Alaska State Leadership Academy, or ASLA. And this program is for early career principals. We have participation from almost every district over the years. And as I said earlier, I really believe that strong leaders help retain teachers. And leadership mentoring is in this bill so that we can assure districts that it will happen year after year, and they won't have to worry each year and wonder if we're going to be able to offer it. That we need the consistency, and we need to know that it's something that's going to happen.
Thank you. We have a question from Rep. Dibert.
Thank you, co-chair, through the chair to Director Schmidt. It's actually on the previous slide. I'm a little slow. I'm still drinking my coffee and waking up. Let's see. Pillar two. And it's on that last box on the exit interviews and data. I'm just kind of curious about the interview and how you're interviewing educators on why they're leaving or staying, which is really great to capture. I'm wondering, my question is, are there any answers that have shocked you? And if they do, do you add them to the survey to capture that from other educators from across the state? Just wondering how that works. Thank you.
Through the chair to Rep. Dibert. That's a great question. I haven't seen the actual survey yet that's being done right now. I think when we go back to that survey that was done with 3,000 teachers, it was surprising to me that six of the top 10 things in there didn't have anything to do with money, that it had more to do with support and the way that leadership treats teachers and having autonomy to be a teacher and to do the things that you learn. So I would bet that there's going to be some things that surprise us that we can work on and change for districts, but I don't know that yet.
We have a question from Rep. Schwanke.
Thank you, through the co-chair. Kind of a question on exit interviews. So one of the things that I was concerned about when we did exit interviews at our local district is that it was done by staff. And I heard from teachers that left the district, there's no way I'm going to give an accurate mm-hmm. response of why I'm leaving, especially if it has to do with leadership. So my concern is with the bill language, it says a school district shall contract with an independent third party to conduct an exit interview. So as it's written, this particular requirement would require each district to do something potentially independent from other districts. And so I'm curious what your thoughts are on this process, something that would be still associated with that district versus more of a statewide approach to a full third-party interview process.
Thank you, through the chair, to Rep. Schwanke. I can see that, and I've heard that exact same thing from people. We're not going to do one from our district and tell what's happening, especially in small areas. I would hope that when it says a third party that everybody uses the same third party and that it's like the state, or we could take something like that on as ACSA to provide a tool to districts to use. There's companies that provide tools. We've had at conferences different vendors come up that have those kinds of things already. I just don't know how Alaska specific they are, because I think we have specific needs and specific questions to ask. But I do see the danger, I guess, in that it being everybody picking their own. So maybe we need to think about a little bit of language behind a more of a statewide survey, something we talk about.
I appreciate that perspective. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
And I would like to add that, or ask, have you thought about the cost to the district? You know, what typically is, like if they used your services as an example, or mm-hmm. have you heard about an independent, you know, contractor? What do they typically charge? You talked about some vendors. What would that cost be to the district?
Thank you, through the chair, Rep. Story. I don't have the information about the cost of it. The survey that's going out right now from the state is an exit and stay, so it's going to every single teacher in Alaska. And I believe the language is more of an exit survey for the people who are leaving, so I wouldn't think that it would be as expensive as a one that goes to everybody. But I can get you information about those vendors and what they're charging and what that would look like. I mean, we obviously want to keep the price as low as possible for our districts.
Thank you. Please proceed.
Okay, and then the last part of this is international certification reciprocity. As you heard earlier, we have a lot of international teachers in our schools, and visa process can be expensive and cumbersome. So, too, can the process of them getting a teaching certificate. When we go to hire an international teacher, they complete what is called a foreign credential evaluation. It's a U.S. company that looks at their resume, or I'm sorry, at their transcripts, and then they report a U.S. equivalency. For example, it might say this teacher would be equivalent to a teacher in the U.S. with a master's degree and 10 years of teaching experience in special education. In our current system, that teacher has to arrive on an emergency certificate until he or she takes the basic praxis test and then reapplies for a license. This is time-consuming and can be expensive for districts. And immigration is such an interesting process. One teacher might apply for a visa, and when the USCIS sees that they're only going to be on a one-year contract, they'll just give them a one-year visa. And when that contract has to be renewed, we have to go through the renewal process. And so that becomes expensive. It's also doesn't necessarily feel equitable if that teacher with a master's degree and 10 years of experience teaching special ed is teaching right next door to a new teacher from the U.S. that has a master's degree, 10 years of experience. They don't have to be on an emergency cert, and this one does. So it creates some issues there. So we just feel that there needs to be some reciprocity. I have to say, though, in this bill, we did meet with Director Manning this week, and I'm not 100% sure that this is the language to make this happen. It's been through legal, and we're trying to figure that out, and we're working together to do that. I believe that DEED wants the same thing that we want. They want teachers to be able to get certificates quickly, and we're still trying to figure out exactly the best way to do that.
Thank you. Rep. Hemshoot has a question.
Thank you. Through the chair, what is an example of an international accrediting association?
Do you mean the one that I just talked about, a foreign credential evaluation that does that?
I'm just speaking to the bill language. It says
yes,
a recognized regional or international accrediting association.
And that's part of the problem in the bill that we just met with Director Manning, is that the language, I believe, is very specific to what a regional U.S. accrediting association is, and we're not sure that it's the same thing internationally. And so that's where we're looking at the language. I think where we're getting caught up is that praxis test. And it seems, I don't want to say unfair, but it kind of seems unfair that we're having somebody come in and they have to go back and take that basic praxis test that got them into college in the first place, like the SAT or the ACT or basic praxis, after they've been, have a master's degree and been teaching all this time. And so we discuss looking at the tests that other countries give and using that test instead of the praxis, and doing like an evaluation of the tests that maybe other countries give, or looking at ways to get around that, because we're not sure about that accreditation piece.
Follow up. Thank you. Through the chair. So I want to make sure I'm understanding correctly. You said a praxis test, but we do require teachers getting their certificate for the first time to pass the praxis test, called the praxis. Are we requiring someone from another state to take the praxis?
We are not requiring somebody from another state to take the praxis if they have had 2 years of teaching experience under a professional license in another state.
Follow up.
Thank you. So through the chair, does that mean we are asking our international teachers with experience to take the praxis?
Yes, it does.
And follow up?
It's my understanding, yes.
Thank you, through the chair. And that requirement Is that set? That must be set by the department.
My understanding is that it's in regulation and that that's something that would have to go to the state board, and that was what the discussion that we just had this week with Director Manning, that that might be the way to remedy this.
I do have another follow-up question. Maybe
I just wanted to note for the record
I interrupt that your presentation, though.
Director Manning is on the line. We can ask questions after the presentation if you still have them.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. So I'm just about finished. As I mentioned earlier, this bill is it's retention and recruitment, and I think it's like an ecosystem. The strategies have to work together. It's not just a menu where we can say, yes, we need this, but not this, and yes, we need that. We can't, you know, it's not going to help. Bonuses are not going to help if there's no housing for teachers to live in that area. And pipeline expansion and getting more and more teachers here isn't going to help if we don't have supported leaders to support them in their schools. Broadband is critical to retain teachers and success, but if we have great, strong internet and broadband in a school, but there's no teachers and students in that school, it's not helpful. So this is not a menu. It's a blueprint. It addresses recruitment and retirement, recruitment and retention through working conditions, housing, leadership, mentoring, and we really believe that this bill does this in a way that's going to help us keep teachers in our state. It's a systems approach. And I believe, in closing, that I think that we all want the same thing for the students in the classrooms and the communities around Alaska. We want classrooms filled with students. We want them to be supported. We want stronger schools. We want quality educators, thriving communities, and a sustainable educator workforce. And I believe that supporting House Bill 231 is exactly one of the steps to get us closer to all of those boxes successfully. It's policy. It's implementation of a plan that's been talked about in our state for the last 6 years. And it's putting those pieces that require policy in place.
Thank you very much. Do I see any other questions? Rep. Eisheid.
Thank you, Co-Chair Story. Through the Co-Chair, Ms. Schmitz, I know in the past you gave some numbers for the cost of educational staff turnover. I know in the past I've heard a number for Alaska school districts in total. It was in the millions, and this is for teacher recruitment and then the cost of the districts when educational staff leave early. Do you have that number at hand?
Through the chair to Rep. Eisheid, I do not have that number, but I'm happy to get that number for you.
Yes, please. And,
okay.
And when you do, having the date stamp or year when that number is generated so we can do an inflationary calculation.
Thank you.
Do I have other questions? Thank you very much for your presentation today. It was very thorough and good to see the blueprint that
thank you
has. I'm going to take a pause to go to Director Manning right now. Yes, you're still online. Thank you for being here this morning, Director Manning. I don't know if you heard the question around the requirement of international teachers who have over 2 years of experience that they need to take the praxis test. I would appreciate any comments that you had on that, and then we might have a couple questions.
Yes. Welcome. Good morning. For the record, this is Kelly Manning, Deputy Director for the Division of Innovation and Education. Excellent. I did hear the question, and it is correct that a new teacher to the state is required to take the praxis exam as a part of the initial certification. So that does apply for out-of-state and for out-of-country educators when they're coming in based off of our statutory language for those requirements. We do have some ways that we can support international candidates in going through the credit evaluation process that was described that then allows their coursework to come over when they come because they are required to have that exam. They do typically right now come on a emergency certificate while they complete all of the requirements for the full professional certificate. It is something that the department has been looking at as well, to look at what are things that we might be able to do to make it so they can come in on a professional certificate, which would give them a longer period of time on that certificate prior to needing to do additional certification requirements. And that would get them the initial certificate, 2-3 year. Then they would have the time to complete the required Alaska Studies and Multicultural Education courses, which would support them with their visa, having a longer visa when they come.
We have a follow-up from Rep. Himshute.
Thank you. Through the chair, Deputy Director Manning, so you said teachers incoming to Alaska, whether it's from out of state or out of country, must take the Praxis. Is that regardless of years of experience? If you're coming into Alaska from anywhere else in the universe with 2 years or more, do you still take the Praxis?
To co-chair Himshute, again, this is Kelly Manning for the record. If an educator comes in with 2 years of teaching experience, there is an out-of-state reciprocity that allows them to come in with that experience and not be required to take the Praxis exam. However, the language of the statute and the regulation limits that to out-of-state, so we have not been able to make that extension to an out-of-country candidate. However, one of the things we are able to do for out-of-state is other states do have other competency exams that are comparable to the Praxis exam. And when an individual is coming on an out-of-state certificate, we can sometimes do an evaluation of their competency exam against the Praxis, and we have some other exams that we accept. And Director Schmitz was talking about that's one of the areas that we've been looking to see if we can find what competency exams other countries are using, because we have a way to evaluate their credits against our requirements, but we don't have a way to evaluate their assessments right now. But that is one of the things that we have been looking at to see if we can help alleviate that transition.
Follow-up, Rep. Himshute.
Thank you, Chair Story. Through the chair, Deputy Director Manning, I'm going to assume that a local district is conducting an interview with an international candidate from any country, because our international standards will apply, to my knowledge, to every country. So can I assume that that local district is making their own assessment of English language proficiency? Or is that something that is done? Is there a required state assessment, or are we entrusting the vetting of English language skills to the local through their interview process and working with the candidate directly? Any thoughts on English language proficiency for international hires?
To co-chair Himshute again for the record, this is Kelly Manning. There is not anything that's happening at the state level, so our assumption is that districts are doing that evaluation of English language proficiency during their hiring process.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Schmitz, if you could come back to the table and please give us an answer to that question as far as districts assessing English language learner skills.
Thank you. For the record, this is Jennifer Schmitz, Director of ARC. We are, as an organization through ARC, conducting screening interviews for districts. And we, as a team, are doing English language screening for districts and then providing them lists of teachers that we feel have passed those screening interviews so that they can use those lists to select to go on to further interviews.
Follow up.
Thank you, through the chair. I'm grateful for that work. I would like to confirm that part of the process, and how do I want to say this? I want to make sure that there is some local interview at some point in this process. So you're like, ARC is providing a basic screening, and then certain candidates are forwarded to districts, and the assumption is they will do
a full interview.
Yeah, more local screening. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yes. And we are not currently working with every district with their international hiring. Some of them had started prior to us. We're working with most of them. So it's up. I mean, it's up to them if they want to be using the screening interviews that we're doing. But we are offering that service.
Okay, quick follow-up.
Follow-up.
Thank you. So I have a little bit of a background in English language learning. And we talk about BICS and CALP, basic interpersonal communication skills, versus cognitive academic language proficiency. And so when I'm working with students, the teachers in their classroom will say, kid's fluent, we don't have a problem here. But the academic language, so my other language is German, you would think I'm fluent if you talk to me over a beer. But if you had me write an essay, you would quickly realize that I'm super fluent in that social language. I am not fluent in academic language in German. So what is there a tool that you use? How are you assessing English language proficiency beyond a conversation? Is there a written component? Any thoughts on that?
We don't have an official tool or a written component. I had the opportunity last year to go to the Philippines with a group of superintendents from Alaska that had been doing this longer than I had. And we did pretty quick interviews while we were there, but a piece of it was a social interview to see about conversation. And then there's a piece of it that was more education vocabulary specific and classroom kinds of questions and things that were more related to being a teacher and the teacher knowledge that was needed here. So we did a little bit of both, but it was, and that's what we're, I learned from them and we're kind of following that same procedure, but it's not anything official as far as a tool.
Final comment.
Final comment, Rep. Himmelschut.
Thank you, through the chair. I guess I just want to point out back in the day when I was a young teacher, you didn't get a job. I worked overseas for a little while as a teacher, and you didn't get a job without a personal interview. And because that relationship is so important, and as the shortage, sort of the onset of the shortage, districts started hiring teachers with an online interview. And then there was even a point at which districts were hiring anybody that they could get. So I want us to be back in the day where there were 10 or 20 teachers for every job, and we're picking the very best of the best, and it's an absolute requirement to have that in-person interview. We're more used to online now, so maybe that can do it. But when I talk about social language, that interview where you figure out the warmth of the person and how they interact with people is super critical. But the cognitive academic language proficiency is probably no less critical to get the outcomes in our schools that we want. So I'm grateful that you guys are doing that sort of frontline in-person. It used to be impossible to get a teaching job if you hadn't been seen at a minimum in person. So I'm grateful for that work. Thank you.
Thank you. I 100% agree with you.
And I had a question having to go back to bonuses, and you had been citing the state of Pennsylvania. Are there any studies showing bonuses are more of an effect in retention versus increasing salaries and benefits?
That's a very good question. I don't know the answer to that. I will certainly do some research and see if there is. That would be interesting.
Yeah, I'd be curious what Pennsylvania has been finding out about why they're turning to that. So anyway, thank you.
We're going
to move on now to our next presentation. And I want to note the time. We have about 30 minutes, maybe 25 to 30 minutes, and I'm very pleased that we have next on our agenda, Superintendent, I have Superintendent Patrick Mayer from the Alaska Gateway School District, who is online, and I also have Elizabeth Cornick Johnson, a superintendent, assistant superintendent from Nome. Who would you like us to start with, Rep. Ferrer? With Patrick. Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you for waiting online and being with us, Superintendent Mayer. We're very grateful for all your work with your students there out in Alaska Gateway. Could you please unmute yourself and introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony?
Yes. Good morning, everyone, and especially good morning, Chair and members of the committee.
For the record, my name is Patrick Mayer, and I serve as the superintendent of the Alaska Gateway School District, and we are based in Tok. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today in support of HB 231. So Alaska Gateway is a small, highly rural district in eastern interior Alaska. We serve about 400 students across seven schools and communities like Tok, Eagle, Northway, Tetlin, Tanacross, Dot Lake, and Mentasta Lake. So our schools are spread across 24,000 square miles, and most are K-12 buildings serving small student populations. That scale and isolation makes staffing one of our biggest challenges. And I want to be very clear, when we even have one or two vacancies, it immediately impacts students. That can mean combining classes, asking teachers to cover outside their content area, or losing opportunities for students altogether. We don't have extra staff to absorb those gaps. HB 231 would directly change that for our district in a few important ways. First, the PERS and TERS flexibility would allow us to grow our own teachers locally. Right now, we have paraprofessionals and community members who are ready to step into teaching roles. They already know our students and our communities, and they're much more likely to stay long term. Current retirement rules make that transition difficult or financially risky, and because of that, we lose potential teachers we already have in our system. This bill will allow us to move those individuals into certified positions, which means fewer vacancies, more stability, and better outcomes for our students. Second, international reciprocity would help us fill positions more quickly and keep classrooms consistently staffed. About one-third of our teachers are international teachers, and without them, we would not be able to operate at our current level. Right now, delays or barriers in certification can leave positions unfilled at the start of the year or create uncertainty for schools. This bill would help streamline that process so qualified teachers can get into classrooms faster. And for us, that means fewer disruptions and more consistency for students. Third, housing support would directly impact whether we can hire and keep teachers. We regularly have situations where we find a qualified candidate and they cannot accept the job because there's no housing available. And even when teachers do come, housing challenges often shorten how long they stay. In fact, as referenced earlier, a 2001 study by the University of Alaska Institute for Social and Economic Research, ICER, found that nearly half of the teachers leaving rural Alaska districts cited the lack of quality housing as a primary reason. If we had more tools to support housing, we would be able to convert more job offers into actual hires and hopefully keep those teachers longer. Finally, recruitment and retention incentives would give us flexibility to respond to real workforce conditions. In our district, being able to offer targeted bonuses can make the difference between filling a position or leaving it vacant. And this is especially true for paraprofessionals who are critical to our schools and are often our future teachers. Those incentives help us compete and help us retain the people we invest in. The bottom line is this. HB 231 would not just help in a general way. It would directly reduce vacancies, shorten the time it takes to fill positions, and help us keep educators we already have. That translates into more consistent instruction, stronger programs, and better outcomes for our students. For a district like Alaska Gateway, that's a significant impact. Thank you very much for your time, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Do I have any questions? I have a question from Rep. Himshute.
Thank you, Superintendent Mayer. Thank you for your years of service in the state and for being here this morning. Through the chair, my question is, who in your district serves as a paraprofessional? Is that a classroom person, or is a paraprofessional contract extended to building secretaries and bus drivers? What is a paraprofessional?
So I'm speaking the term paraprofessionals, ones that actually have classroom involvement, and so they might be a special education paraprofessional or someone else. We have 26 of them throughout our district, but they're scattered in different sites. So those would reference our instructional side paras.
Follow up. Thank you. Through the chair, do you have a wall-to-wall contract, so to speak, or do you have a separate negotiated agreement with your paraprofessionals?
So they're covered, generally speaking, under their classified negotiated agreement.
Follow-up. Thank you. So through the chair, then, if we were going to provide bonuses to paraprofessionals, would that – so would all the people in the classified staff be eligible, or it would be limited to – like you would locally determine the paraprofessionals in your classified bargaining unit that would get the bonuses? So the classroom paraprofessionals would, but not the other folks in that bargaining unit, like the building secretaries or bus drivers or – And it's different in every district, so I'm just wondering in your district what that would look like.
So just, for example, bus drivers, we contract with an organization locally. They do a great job for us for transportation. So that every, I guess where I'm going with that is every district is a little different, and I would want to see established criteria there for how those would be distributed. Certainly we don't want to exclude anyone because an executive assistant at a school plays a very important role, as does a classroom paraprofessional. So I think the it'll be important to look at details and criteria for how those potential bonuses would be distributed.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. We have a question from Rhett Dibert, and then I'm going to go on to the next presentation because we have two more, and I want to make sure we get our guests on here today. So Rep. Dibert.
Thank you, co-chair. Through the co-chair to Superintendent Luke.
Mayor.
My apologies. This isn't Lake and Penn. Nope. Thank you for your presentation. It's for the next presenter. Thank you for all your hard work you do for students.
You bet. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Yes, thank you. And I do note in the bill that the Department of Education Early Development may adopt regulations to carry on the purposes of the bonuses. And I think this is a really important discussion that I hope we'll have at some point, because do you offer a bonus, half of it at Christmas time, half of it at the end of the year? I think if you offer it up front, that is a very it's probably risky. Not going to get us the results that we want. So anyway, I'll be very curious to discuss that at some more point along the path of this bill. And again, we are very grateful for your longtime service to our state and children and families and the teaching staff. So have a great day. Thank you, Superintendent. Next, I'm to go on to Elizabeth Kornick Johnson, who's the assistant superintendent and the human resources director with the Nome School District. Please unmute yourself, introduce yourself for the record, and begin your testimony.
Good morning, Co-Chair Representative Himshut, Co-Chair Representative Story, and members of the House Education Committee. Thank you for the opportunity to provide testimony this morning in support of House Bill 231. Sponsored by Representative Frayer. For the record, I am Elizabeth Kornick Johnson, Assistant Superintendent and HR Director for Nome Public Schools, a 25-year educator, 43-year Nome resident, and lifelong Alaskan. So imagine, if you will, a small Alaskan school district of 675 students, 60 certified staff, 20 classified staff, preparing for the upcoming school year with over a dozen certified vacancies and only 10 qualified domestic applicants, accompanied by many high-quality international applicants. It's not the start of a fictional story. It is our immediate reality in Nome Public Schools. This is duplicated and multiplied in districts across our state. While the challenges are many, the solutions are possible. An investment in the retention of current staff and recruitment of high-quality educators is critical. HB 231 outlines this investment. Investing in a robust mentorship program for school principals and district superintendents reduces early career attrition. As a career-long Alaskan educator, I have benefited from both the Alaska School Leadership Academy and Mentorship Program and the new and incoming Superintendent's Support and Mentorship Program. Much like mentorship for our new to Alaska and new to career teachers, school and district leaders need guidance and support in their crucial roles. School administration is a lonely place to be, and this can be magnified in small districts where you don't have administrative colleagues to reach out to, or your issues and concerns seem isolated. Administrators work hard to support their staff, students, and families. Being able to facilitate growth for individuals and improvement of systems helps instill confidence of teachers in their administrators. When a teacher or support staff member can trust his or her administrator wants the best for them, their students, and their community because they see it in their leader's actions, they're more likely to stay in that school or district. Being a part of these mentorship programs has provided me personally with the knowledge and skills through the appropriate lenses, allowed me to expand my network of colleagues across the state, and help to facilitate my growth and success as a school and district leader. The reality of 12 certificated vacancies and fewer domestic applicants is not a new issue. While we continue to advertise and recruit within Alaska and the rest of the United States, the majority of our qualified candidates are international teachers. The processes and costs associated with securing visas and certification in order for these candidates to teach in our schools are complicated and exorbitant. Often a visa's expiration date will coincide with the expiration date of an Alaskan-issued emergency teacher certificate, which Director Schmitz referenced earlier. This is June 30th of the year, the school year in which it was issued. So that means just after having the teacher arrive and begin their work with us, we are beginning to file the processes again for those visas and emergency certificates with all the same fees attached. This amounts to thousands of dollars per individual and may be necessary for 2 or 3 years, depending on their certification status. These teachers are coming to our districts with multiple degrees in education and many years of teaching experience under their belts. HB 231 would allow the Department of Education and Early Development to recognize degrees earned from accredited institutions when issuing certificates to teach in Alaska. If a teacher coming from another state with program verification and 2 years or more of teaching under that license can be deemed qualified as a professional in our state, why shouldn't the same apply to our international employees? These educators, with their accomplishments and experience, bring diverse perspectives and expertise that enrich our schools and communities. In recent years, one of our biggest challenges in recruiting high-quality teachers and school administrators, especially those located within the United States, has been the salary offer. The reality is many Alaskan districts are not as competitive as we once were. We have had several candidates say that they really want to come and teach in our community, but they cannot justify the often more than $10,000 reduction in pay. Despite continued but careful increases in our pay scales, we just aren't meeting the mark. A state-supported retention budget would significantly impact these conversations in a positive way. To be able to tell an individual during the recruitment process that they will receive that bonus simply by finishing out the year could be the deciding factor for many. And to be able to tell them that they will receive it a second year by sticking around only increases the likelihood that they will choose to come and choose to stay. While we as individual districts and as a state continue to make improvements in our systems and strategies, those individuals will be here, becoming vested in our communities, falling in love with our towns and our people, as all of us have done. Finally, I would like to address the requirement for exit interviews of staff who decide to leave our schools. As the sole individual responsible for all things human resources in our district, I welcome the resource of an independent third party to complete this crucial task, enabling our district and state to garner important data regarding our schools and systems. Whether designed as an online survey or a phone conversation with an outside entity, this provides for standardized information and comfort in responding, as well as increasing the likelihood that the task is completed. We need consistent and honest data statewide to help us understand why teachers are leaving our districts so we can better address retention issues. HB 231 is not merely an appropriations bill, it is a strategic investment in the stability and future of Alaska's education system, aligned with the governor's teacher recruitment and retention initiatives. It provides the necessary tools for districts like Nome Public Schools to turn a reality of chronic vacancies into one of fully staffed classrooms with dedicated, well-supported educators for our children. I urge the House Education Committee to advance HB 231. Thank you for your time, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you for your testimony. Do I have any questions? I would have a question from Rep. Schwanke.
Thank you, through the chair. Ms. Koenig-Johnson, I butchered your name, I'm sorry. Could you help us understand from your perspective as an administrator in a remote community, is it more beneficial for a new administrator to have some form of one-time conference setting training as a support mechanism, or kind of ongoing opportunities to meet with colleagues and peers from around the state?
Representative Schwanke, through the chair, I definitely believe that it's important, just like with our teachers, that our school and district administrators have ongoing support. Both ASLA, the Alaska School Leadership Academy, and the new and incoming superintendent support provide that throughout the year. They have online meetings with cohorts, and then there are in-person opportunities as well that are usually aligned to other educator conferences. So those individuals are already traveling out of district for another purpose. So those mentorship programs are designed to facilitate that. And that has been very helpful to have that ongoing kind of job embedded support, just like it is for our teachers.
Thank you.
Thank you. And we'll take a question from Rep. Eichheit, and then we'll go to our final presentation.
Thank you, Co-Chair Story. Through the co-chair, can you repeat the initial statistics you said in terms of vacancies and job applicants, I believe, for Nome? Can you just repeat that? That was kind of startling, and I didn't get it, but I want to be restartled, I guess, please.
Certainly, through the chair, to Representative Eichheit. So we currently have a dozen certified vacancies, so that's teaching staff vacant for next year, and only 10 qualified domestic applicants, many high-quality international applicants. But as Director Schmitz mentioned earlier, and as is required by the visa process, we are always looking domestically first. And those are the numbers we have.
Thank you for those numbers, and thank you very much for your work in public education and with your students and communities. We're very grateful. So now we will go on to our final presentation for the day, and I'm just going to hold questions till the end. And we have with us Luke, Superintendent of Lake and Penn Peninsula School District. Please unmute yourself, introduce yourself for the record, and begin your testimony. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Story. Can you hear me?
Yes, okay, a little faint, but we'll see. Hopefully it gets stronger, and I see that we have someone doing the slides for you in the room, Ms. Wilson. So please proceed.
I will do my best. Thank you. I will do my best to project. Good morning, Chair Story, Co-Chair Himshute, and members of the House Education Committee. For the record, my name is Casey Luke. I serve the Lake and Peninsula School District as superintendent. I have been in this role for nearly 5 years, and before taking on this position, I served in Lake and Penn for 10 years in a variety of roles. Lake and Penn is a very remote school district in Southwest Alaska, and a proud partner in the Bristol Bay Region Career and Technical Education Program, BBRCTE. I state this as I will reference the partnership throughout my testimony regarding the benefits of our districts working together through this incredible program to provide resources for educators and children in our region. I'm here today mainly to share with you the remote reality of our schools and explain why HB 231 is a vital tool for the stability of our communities and for Alaska schools. I'm going to begin by referencing slide 3. This will talk about turnover as you follow along. The reality in LPSD is that losing just one employee from year to year costs the district between $25,000 and $30,000. We are facing a deepening crisis. Our certified teacher turnover in between 2024 and 2025 was 20%, and in FY26 it has climbed to 29%. Beyond the dollars that I've given example of, the turnover, the high turnover in our school district prevents students from feeling safe and feeling known. And this is such a critical component that when a teacher leaves, a piece of stability in the community leaves with them. The HB 231 solution provides the scale needed to make staying the standard by offering bonuses between the $5,000 and $15,000 for recruitment and retention. I want to take you with me to Perryville, if you will, Perryville, Alaska. It is one of the most beautiful places on earth where Eagle Pride runs deep. It's also a place where a round-trip ticket to Anchorage town costs $1,400. In Perryville, many remote coastal communities, in Perryville and in many of our remote coastal communities, we are intimately familiar with weathering. We see the wind and the waves physically reshape our coastline every year. We know what happens when the ground starts to wash away. There is an invisible erosion happening inside our school walls that is far more dangerous than the storm surge outside. Perryville will see 100% teacher turnover next year, and this is for the third year in a row. If you think about that, in the time it takes a middle schooler to get to high school, every single face in their certified teacher support system has vanished. When teachers leave, trust erodes, and when trust erodes, student engagement washes away. This isn't just a staffing challenge, it's a foundational collapse. Our students are forced to reintroduce themselves to their own education every single August because the adults in the room are strangers. With this coming year, the storm is hitting its peak, not only with 100% turnover of teachers, but also the principal will be moving on. We are effectively hitting the reset button on the entire community's future. These students are the ones who suffer the weathering of a system that hasn't found a way to anchor its talent in remote Alaska. We can build seawalls to stop physical erosion, and we must find the policy anchors to stop this relational erosion. We owe it to the Eagles in Perryville to give them this foundation that doesn't wash away every spring. I'm going to move to slide 4, talking a bit about housing and the barrier of housing. In remote Alaska, if there is no housing available, there simply can't be teachers placed there. Teachers aren't the priority typically in our communities, especially with local community members and families who are struggling also to find housing. LPSD has had to provide subsidized housing at an average rate of 62% over the last 8 years just to keep the doors open or to keep options open for housing. The HB 231 solution is that this bill creates grant programs to help districts fund these subsidies and crucially perform repairs and upgrades so that educator housing is safe and habitable. Moving to slide 5. And talking about data retention and our exit survey. Right now, Alaska lacks reliable statewide data on why teachers leave. In LPSD, we formalized our own exit surveys and found that 44% of departing staff cite retirement or financial instability, not necessarily a lack of love for their job, as their reason for leaving. Interestingly, 92% of our departing staff say their relationships with students were the absolute highlight of their careers. We aren't losing them because they want to go. We're losing them because they can't afford to stay. One of the solutions in HB 231 is that it formalizes an exit interview process statewide, turning the potential of a resignation into a contribution toward future policy. Moving on to slide 6.
Superintendent Luke, excuse me for interrupting you, but when you say have your teaching staff as 100% turnover, I'm assuming you are staying, and are your paraprofessionals much more long-term, or are you referring to everyone?
Chair Story, the example I gave about 100% turnover was specifically for Perryville, Alaska School.
For clarification, is that for the paraprofessionals too?
Chair Story, no, that is simply for the certified staff, which includes teachers and the principal.
Thank you. Please proceed.
Slide six is where I'll be talking next about grow your own successes. The only 38% of Alaska's certified workforce is Alaska Native. To change this, LPSD has worked with four paraprofessionals across our district who are becoming Grow Your Own apprentices. This program has a goal of allowing our paraprofessionals to become full-time teachers. This allows them to complete their apprenticeship at sites in their home community with their family. They don't have to leave to acquire this education. I wanted to highlight with this that in growing our own, the transition between retirement systems through the PERS and TERS can sometimes hurt these employees financially. HB 231 has a solution embedded that allows the transfer of contributions between systems under specific circumstances, valuing the experience of our local paraprofessional staff and keeping them on the path to certification without losing their retirement security. If I may, I invite you to come back with me to Perryville, to Perryville School, and I want to share with you a story of Kaylin Hobson. Kaylin is a graduate of the Lake and Peninsula School District class of 2014. And for the past 8 years, Kaylin has served in Perryville School as a dedicated paraprofessional. I first knew Kaylin when she was a student and I was serving as a school counselor for Lake and Penn. Today, she is a mother of two children. They are in our school and she has a clear professional goal of becoming a certified teacher. Kaylin is the gold standard of what recruitment should look like in Alaska, a local caring adult invested in her community's future. However, for a grow your own candidate like Kaylin, the path to certification shouldn't come with financial penalty. And my final slide, slide seven, regarding leadership and professional growth. Teachers have stated in Lake and Penn when they feel supported by strong principals and administration, they are more likely to stay in their school or within the district. LPSD currently focuses on paraprofessional support, as mentioned prior, certified educator support, as well as contractual agreement supports with our certified educators around advancement in education. We have a master's degree in culturally responsive education with UAA and our BBRCD program, as well as monetary incentives to individuals who do not leave. So certified individuals who stay. These incentives alongside supportive administration create a tier system that truly makes a difference. Alongside this tier system is where HB 231 comes in, supporting the continued operation of statewide mentoring programs for principals and superintendents. We feel that where leadership is stable, the classroom is stable. In closing, I encourage the commitment to HB 231. We are committed to supporting HB 231. That's why I'm here. We believe that the stability of schools and communities in remote Alaska is imperative. It transforms the educator experience from temporary service to long-term contribution. I appreciate you listening to my testimony this morning in support of HB 231, and I'm open to questions.
Thank you, Superintendent Luke. I'm going to go to Rep. Dybert. She had a question for you, and then we are unfortunately going to be running out of time.
Okay. Good morning. Thank you through the co-chair to Superintendent Luke. Thank you for your presentation and for all of your work with Alaska students and educators. My question is, I recently learned that Lake and Penn last year lost their funding for food, or students aren't getting breakfast and lunch through the traditional route that the rest of Alaska is. And when we think about our educators, is that putting a stress on them at all? Or just curious when we talk about teacher retention and feeding our kids. Thank you.
Superintendent Luke.
Thank you, Chair Story. Through the chair, Representative Dybert, I'm grateful for the question. The choice of our school board to reduce our school lunch program was one of the most incredibly difficult decisions our school board has ever made, and at least in my time. And it definitely impacts the responsibility that falls on our district leaders, meaning our principals at school sites or our itinerant leadership. I think inadvertently, we've had some feedback at some communities who have hosted their own lunch program that the transition of the National School Lunch Program to local oversight has benefited our students and our staff, that there is less waste, there is more involvement in where food comes from, where it comes from, and the learning of where it comes from, as well as the involvement of the community in problem solving during times when the school district is at such a budget deficit situation. So to answer your question more pointedly, I do think that it puts stress on our administration. I don't know if I can answer pointedly if it puts stress particularly on our certified staff, but our classified staff and those involved in our schools who have children in school, who are parents, as staff members, absolutely. We're constantly trying to work with our communities to figure out how to ensure that there is nutritional meals in our schools through local contribution and support.
Thank you for that information. I'm going to allow Rep. Hemshoot to have a comment.
Thank you. Through the chair, very quickly, I spent a few days in Perryville, and it is paradise. It is fabulous out there. So I hope you will find educators who will stick. And at the time, there were a couple who had taught in Lake and Penn. It was quite a while ago, but they had taught for several years in maybe Igagik or Igiagik, and then they went out to Perryville, and they stayed for quite a while. They were master teachers. It was wonderful to meet them and to see the community. So thank you for taking me back to Perryville.
And thank you very much, Superintendent Luke, for your commitment to your community and your staff and children. And I want to thank all the presenters today and their very thorough information that they have given the committee, and thank Representative Freer for her work, and Lucretia for your work too. And so with that, I will hold House Bill 231 over. In closing today, I want to remind the committee that on Monday, March 23rd, the House Education Committee will hear a presentation celebrating excellence in education by Representative Underwood. And then we will hear House Bill 380, Residential School Funding, from House Education Committee, carried by Representative Hemshoot. We will have invited and public testimony on that. Then we will have House Bill 374, Base Student Allocation, from Representative Hemshoot, testimony and invitation only. And then we will have a bill from Senator Gray Jackson, Senate Bill 20, CPR Curriculum. This concludes our House Education Committee hearing today. The time is 9:58, and the House of Education Committee is